Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Mark Zitter, a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, chair of the Zetima Project, and your moderator for today. It's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, Dan Buettner, who is a National Geographic Fellow, an explorer, and New York Times best-selling author, whose new book is The Blue Zones of Happiness, Lessons from the World's Happiest People. He's also author of the cover story in this month's National Geographic that's focused on happiness around the world. Dan has made a career out of exploring the globe and chronicling his amazing travels, from record-shattering cycling trips across the USSR, Africa, and the Americas, to groundbreaking work on the disappearance of ancient indigenous civilizations. Dan has been at the forefront of international adventure for decades. In addition to being a best-selling author and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker, Dan is leading the study of blue zones across the world. Blue zones are locations ranging from Okinawa, Japan, to Sardinia, Italy, to Loma Linda down in Southern California, where people live exceptionally long and happy lives, significantly longer than those in the immediately surrounding communities. Dan has been studying for quite some time what makes those blue zones so healthy. Now, of course, longevity is great, but most of us would like to add not only years to our lives, but as they say, life to our years. So realizing this, Dan began looking for places where residents were not only long-lived, but also exceptionally happy. His new book reveals the surprising secrets of the world's happiest places and gives us the tools to achieve true happiness and longevity in our own lives. And I predict you'll all have some take-home benefit to this talk that can help you be happier in your own lives. So let's please give a warm Commonwealth Club welcome to Dan Buettner.
Thank you, Mark. I thought it'd actually be fun to get started today by identifying the happiest people in the audience. And I can actually do that. I just have to ask you two either-or questions, and your job is to raise your hand when it applies to you. So the first question is about whether or not you think life is long or short. You can only vote once. So raise your hand if you think life is long. Okay, about a third of you. Now raise your hand if you think life is short. Two-thirds, all right. Now raise your hand that next question is about if you think life is hard or easy. Okay, you can only vote once. Raise your hand if you think life is hard. Now raise your hand if you think life is easy. All right. So I want everybody who thinks that life is long and easy to stand up. Everybody who thinks life is long and easy, stand up. All right. So a few years ago, a Harvard researcher by the name of Mark Norberg led an international team of experts. Stay standing up. I won't ridicule you too much. And correlated those very questions with happiness, civics, and generosity. And he actually found that the least happy people think that life is short and hard. And that's the majority. Only about 20% of people think life is long and easy, and that represents the happiest people. They're about 30% happier, about 50% more likely to vote, and 60% more likely to give money. So if we could give the people standing up a big Commonwealth round of applause. You guys are all invited to my next fundraiser. So I'm going to talk about the world's happiest people and the lessons they have to teach us. But first I'd like to sort of rewind the tape a little bit. For the past 15 or so years, I've been working with National Geographic and developed a bit of an expertise at finding the measurably most extraordinary populations on Earth and then distilling their wisdom for the rest of us. And this actually began with a project on longevity. In 2005, I wrote the cover story for National Geographic, Secrets of Living Longer, where we did just that. We found the evidence-based parts of the world where people live the longest, so-called blue zones areas. And these are, it took us two years to find these places. We worked with demographers. And these places, Loma Linda, California, Nicoya, Costa Rica, longest lived men in the world, Sardinia, Italy, longest lived women, Okinawa, Japan, and Ikaria, Greece, where dementia is almost unheard of. Statistically longest lived places. Then in a sense, we reverse engineered what they did. This required about 20 trips to these places and a multidisciplinary team of experts. And just to jump to the bottom line, because we're talking about happiness today. There were 9 common denominators no matter where you go, and you see extraordinarily long-lived people, and they are, 1, they don't exercise as much as they live in a place where they're nudged into movement once every 20 minutes. Their houses are deconvenienced. There's not a button to push for yard work, another button to push for housework, another button to push for kitchen work. They're kneading bread by hand or grinding corn. They have gardens, and they're definition of recreation is often walking, but none of the sort of schedule it on Outlook and then go to the treadmill. You don't see that. They worry about the same things that we do, but they have sacred daily rituals to reverse the stress and inflammation from everyday life. In Okinawa, it's ancestor veneration. In Ikaria and Costa Rica, they take a nap. In Sardinia, they just do happy hour, but reverse thing. They have vocabulary for purpose, which we're finding now is way more important than we think when it comes to longevity. Founding director of the National Institutes on Aging, Robert Butler, authored a landmark study that found that people could articulate the reason for which they wake up in the morning, live about 8 years longer than people who are rudderless. And in Blue Zones areas, there's vocabulary for purpose. Plan de vida in Costa Rica, ikigai in Okinawa, but they're a very clear path for life. Good news for most of us here, they drink a little bit, a couple glasses a day, and no, you can't save up all week long and have 14 on Saturday. My second Blue Zones book, Blue Zone Solution, did a meta-analysis of all 5 Blue Zones areas, dietary surveys done over the last 100 years, 155 dietary studies, and if you average them all out, you see that what centenarians are really eating to live to 100 is largely a high-carbohydrate diet. Now, you have to be careful with high carbohydrates because both lollipops and lentils are carbohydrates. So we're talking about the lentil type of carbohydrates. 90 to 100% plant-based. The longest-lived Americans, actually, are Seventh-day Adventists who are pescatarian or vegan. That's comes from an epidemiology study that followed 103,000 Americans for 30 years. The cornerstone of every longevity diet in the world are grains, greens, nuts, and beans. If you're eating about a cup of beans a day, it's probably adding about 3 years to your life expectancy. They do eat meat, but very sparingly, maybe 4 times a month, a piece about the size of this clicker. Maybe they'll, you know, pig out once a month or so, but meat is a celebratory food. Fish, not nearly as much as you'd think. No cow's dairy anyway, so no beef. You'll see a little pecorino cheese in Sardinia, a little feta in Greece, but none of the gobs of cheese we see here in America. And when it comes to consumption, 6 glasses of water a day, herbal teas of all sorts, and then good news for most of us, coffee, one of the great indulgences we can enjoy daily with impunity, and then a little bit of wine. Soda pop is virtually unknown to Blue Zones centenarians. So this is sort of the meta-analysis in the food guidelines. I don't promote necessarily a diet, but it's very clear the patterns of what people eat who live manifestly longest. They have strategies to keep from overeating. They tend to eat meals with their family. There's not electronics in their kitchen, so they're not mindlessly eating with their TV show. They tend to eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, and dinner like a pauper. And then the foundation of all of this, and you don't hear much about this because you can't wrap it up and market it to people, but I would say it's 50% of the longevity formula. They invest heavily in their family. They keep their aging parents nearby, which conveys probably 2 to 6 extra years of life expectancy to those aging parents. Invest in their children, invest in their spouses. They tend to be religious. People who show up to church, temple, or mosque 4 times a month live in 4 to 14 years longer than people who don't. There's a variety of explanations for that, but it's one of those things you can stack the deck in favor. Inner city minorities get the biggest bump from this particular strategy. And then I would say if there's one thing to pay attention to, of all nine of these, the biggest one is who you hang out with. We now know that if our three best friends are obese and unhealthy, there's 150% better chance that you'll be overweight yourself. In blue zones areas, people surround themselves with people who eat the right way, people who care about you, people's idea of recreation as physical activity, walking or gardening. It's really curating that group of five friends. The Okinawans call this a moai, a committed social network of the right people. So these are the nine components. And I'm sure you look at these and you nod your head and say, yeah, it makes a lot of sense. But the real aha here, epiphany comes not in knowing exactly what to do, but how a cluster of behaviors appear together all the time. So they're underpinned by, they have a strong sense of purpose, which makes it easier for them to move naturally and to eat wisely for decades, long enough to avoid the diseases that foreshorten our lives. They surround themselves with the right people who reinforce those behaviors, and then they live in a community that facilitates them. So diets don't exist in a vacuum. Nobody in this audience can tell me of one diet that works for more than 3% of the people after 2 years. Exercise programs usually wear out after about 9 months. But what makes the right kind of living sustained for the decades or lifetime necessary to yield long life is this mutually enforcing web of characteristics that always travel together in any place where you see extraordinary longevity. So when it comes to longevity, even though it's painstakingly difficult, the methodology for measuring it, because at the end of the day, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And working for National Geographic, where you know facts actually matter, we had to make sure that these places were academically underpinned as longest lived. And the way you confirm that a place is technically longest lived is you have to find a swath of birth 100 years ago, so say between 1915 and 1920. And you have to follow all of those people in that cohort for 100 years. And you adjust for immigration, emigration, and then who's left over, who's alive, that gives you, I'm slightly overstating this, but who's still alive after 100 years, that gives you the ability to count and confirm longevity. So places like the Caucasus and Soviet Georgia, debunked. Vilcabamba Valley of Ecuador, debunked. Hunza Valley of Pakistan, debunked. Most of places that claim to be blue zones in the world right now aren't. Blue zone is a concept, not really a geographical attribution. So that's how you measure longevity, but happiness is a rather more amorphous topic. How do you measure happiness? You know, you could see somebody laughing today, but they may be depressed the rest of the week, or they may be exaggerating their happiness or understating it, or maybe they just had a few cocktails. How do you measure it? Well, there's facial recognition. There's 360-degree interviews of the people around you. The most interesting and the newest way to measure happiness is emerging right now, and it has to do with how we act online. I brokered a study between Google, Gallup, and the World Wellbeing Project at the University of Pennsylvania. And we found out that what you search for on Google is actually a better predictor of your happiness than your education level and even your income level. And what we did is we pulled 5 billion searches and correlated them with life satisfaction. And we found that people who are Googling looking for information about their dog are happier than people who are doing searches about their cat. People who search for action movies and comedies are happier than people who are searching for romances. And in case you prefer romance by yourself in the privacy of your own room, those people who are Googling for softcore porn are happier than those looking for hardcore porn. Don't worry, it was anonymized data, so I don't know anything about you guys. But the For this project, we took a more straightforward. It turns out over the last 40 years, an enormous ocean of data has accumulated about measuring happiness and the correlations. And the best work is being done by Gallup, the World Poll, and the World Database of Happiness out of University of Rotterdam. And the way you measure happiness on an international level is you start with a standardized survey, and then you pick a randomized sample of 3,000 to 5,000 people in countries, 151 countries. And with that, you can find out what correlates with happiness, and you can also identify the happiest places in the world, which is the exercise that I did before I started this story. And it was a big exercise. So let me explain a little bit more about this, and we'll start with the survey. Here's the ways the surveys work. So, you know, with the correlations, you have independent variables and dependent variables. And the independent variables in this case are different ways to measure happiness. So happiness, by the way, is a meaningless term academically. You can't measure happiness. But you can measure daily emotions in the last 24 hours. How much have you felt stress, and how often have you smiled, how much have you laughed, etc. You can measure purpose by asking people if they use their strengths to do what they do best every day. And you can ask questions about life satisfaction by asking people to think of their life as a whole, and on a scale of 1 to 10, to self-rate, 1 being the worst imaginable life, 10 being the your best possible life. And maybe if you ask an individual, you'll get huge variation, but when you're asking 1,500 random people, those variations equal each other out. You have some people exaggerate and some people understate, but on average, you get a really accurate read, and at the national level, there's huge variations at the individual level. So once you ask these questions, then you can ask a number of other questions about their demographics, their gender, their ethnicities, their values, what they do with their day. And through this statistical maneuver called a regression analysis, you can see exactly what sorts of characteristics tend to accompany happiness in all three places. But when you just spew statistics, people's eyes start to glaze over. People like a story. So the approach for Blue Zones and Happiness and for this story in National Geographic this month, I asked the statisticians to tell me where in the world best demonstrates the best daily experience, the highest sense of purpose, and the highest life satisfaction. And once they identified it, I struck off. So oddly, the area in the world with the highest life satisfaction is actually the happiest place in Asia. Does anybody want to guess the happiest place in Asia? Bhutan. I heard about three Bhutan. That is the biggest PR whitewash that's ever happened. Bhutan is number 91 in the world. To be happy, you need food, shelter, health care, and enough education. Not enough people have those basics. They have a wonderful Buddhist religion there and beautiful mountains, but they don't have the basics for happiness. Actually, counterintuitively and indeed shockingly, but verified over several waves of surveys, the happiest place in Asia is at the end of the Malay Peninsula, the small island nation of Singapore. That probably raises eyebrows because, oh, I've heard they cane people over there. But on the other hand, it's the most successful economic experiment in human history. Their economy has doubled 15 times since 1965. They have one of the highest GDPs in the world. And GDP is correlated with happiness, especially for poorer countries. Spotlessly clean. One of the highest life expectancies in the world, second in the world. One of the best hospital systems. This is actually a hospital in Singapore. And this is really the work of a very clever Cambridge-educated lawyer who became the prime minister of Singapore in the mid-1960s, Lee Kuan Yew. Brilliant man, speaks the Queen's English. And he was supremely imbued with sort of standard Confucian values. You know, we have these Judeo-Christian self-actualization values in the West. In Asia, there's a different set of values that prevail. And Confucian values, I'm going to sum it up, but they're big on harmony, security, respect for elders, respect for authority, etc. And he metabolized that into an environment that allowed people to live out those values supremely. So the harmony thing, he adopted a melting pot of a country of Indians, Malay, Muslims, and Chinese, the dominant ethnicity in Singapore. But rather than letting one of them reign supreme, ignored all their languages, made English the lingua franca there, so everybody was on equal linguistic footing, made sure that all their children go to the same school, they have the same job opportunities. He understood that people who own their own homes take better care of them than people who rent, so he set up a scheme so it was very easy for 85% of all Singaporeans to own their own home. Great sense of security with that, financial security, but also made sure that every high-rise community there reflected the ethnic diversity of the entire country. So every high-rise has some Malay, some Indian, and some Chinese. So there's no Malay ghetto or Chinese gated community. Really big on security, tough on crime. If you get caught with more than a half an ounce of an opioid, you hang. If you're male and you commit a violent crime, you get caned. Very short prison sentence, but you're going to experience some corporal punishment. As a result, it has about the lowest rates of crime in the world. And you know, we have this horrible opioid problem in America. Singapore has almost zero opioid problem. A child can walk any place in Singapore day or night. When it comes to happiness, you know, we talk a lot about freedom in this country, and freedom's important, but actually when it comes to correlation with happiness, security trumps freedom. We'd much rather feel safe and secure than have the ability to go out and protest or the ability to, buy porn or all the other things, whatever else comes with freedom. So this is a place that has been shaped for Confucian values, safe and secure. The path for success is very neatly outlined. You work hard, you forego today's pleasures, you keep your nose to the grindstone, and at the end of that road lays financial security and status. And those are the things that favor this life satisfaction. Life satisfaction at the end of the day is less about how you feel every day and more about your happiness in the rearview mirror. Have I lived out my values? Do I feel secure financially and otherwise? Am I proud of my life? So Singapore, the example of life satisfaction. On the other side of the planet, very different happiness hotspot, Denmark. And specifically, we focused on Aarhus in the north and Aalborg in the north. Now, Denmark's an extraordinary place, about the same size as Singapore population-wise. But this is a place where values of equality, trust. Trust is one of the highest correlates of happiness at a nation level. Tolerance. This is a place where you can be gay or a woman or old or whatever you want to be and live out your values in the West supremely without any judgment. Every man, woman, and child in the entire country has guaranteed health care. You know, the old stories about Denmark, they used to say that the Danes were happy because they're easily satisfied. They're not easily satisfied. They expect free health care. In this country, 15% of Americans don't know what's going to happen to them if they get sick, which is a huge source of free education. And not only free education, when you go to college students get paid to go to school. And a guaranteed comfortable retirement. So this sets up a situation where it's easier to live out your purpose. So the Danes aren't real big on ambition and showing off. It's one of those cultures where the tall tree gets chopped down. They call it Jantelov. And taxes are high, but they're not much higher than they are where I live in Minneapolis, by the way, when you add federal and state taxes. But, you know, you're kind of taxed to the mean in Denmark. So you get rid of status, you get rid of need to take care of your necessities, and you get rid of this notion that you're going to get absurdly rich easily. It's a situation where it's really easy to pursue jobs that really speak to your strengths and your passions. And not coincidentally, Denmark's a place where design and architecture and furniture design all excel. These, on average, they're working 37 hours a week. They're taking 6 weeks of vacation a year, really taking vacation. And it's a place where it's really easy to live out your passions rather than getting clouded by other things that don't deliver as much happiness, whether your passion happens to be rabbit jumping or bicycling naked. Don't try this at home. And then finally, the part of the world where people enjoy their lives most on a day-to-day basis, highest positive emotions, is in the Central Valley of Costa Rica, specifically an area called Cartago, actually. It's an area where the temperature only varies about 10 degrees a year, between 65 and 75 degrees. You have these gorgeous volcanoes and verdant slopes that produce some of the nicest coffee in the world. But Costa Rica, believe it or not, is actually a place where most people's needs are taken care of. 100 years ago, when dictators were, military dictators were running Central America, Costa Rica voted teachers in as presidents. And this is a place where the most important values are not getting rich. Rather, it's family, it's religion, and it's social interaction. The happiest people in the world are socially interacting 5 to 6 hours a day, and that's face-to-face, not Facebook. And the Costa Ricans will never forego a good social opportunity in favor of doing a little bit more work, at least not in general. So you have three types of happiness: the Singapore brand, the Denmark brand, and the Costa Rica brand. And I argue that just like your financial planner will encourage you to own cash, stocks, and bonds, maybe in different proportion, I argue that you should be aware of the three flavors of happiness and have a balanced portfolio, not over favor one, which many of us tend to do. And now, through this correlation science with the millions and millions of data, we can see exactly what sorts of behaviors and goals favor each kind of happiness. For example, when it comes to life satisfaction, you're better off to work full-time and make at least $75,000 a year so you're financially secure. But if purpose is more important for you, you might take time off to take care of an aging parent or an ailing spouse. You get very clear on what your values are, what your strengths are, what your passions are, and an outlet of those. And if you want to maximize your daily experience, you want to get at least 7 hours of sleep a day. If you're sleeping 6 hours, you're probably 30% less happy than you would be if you got adequate sleep. You want to laugh daily, and you want to get at least 6 weeks of vacation. There's another set of factors that favor at least two of these domains of happiness. Belonging to a faith, going to college and have kids favors life satisfaction and purpose. By the way, having kids does not favor daily emotions, at least for the first 18 years. meditating and volunteer favors purpose and daily emotions. And then trying new things and having sex twice weekly makes life pretty nice, both in the long and short term. But there's a sweet spot of things you can do that will favor all three of these domains. Picking a job that speaks to your passions rather than just pay, because most Americans spend most of their day waking hours working. Getting that right's really important. Socializing 6 to 7 hours a day. Owning a dog favors both longevity and happiness. Finding a partner that's right for you. And by the way, when it comes to partners, you're better off if you're depressed to find a depressed partner. And if you're happy, find a happy partner. Those two types of relationships seem to work, but when you try to, you have a real happy one and a dour partner, that often falls apart. And then the right home. Now, if happiness is a cake recipe, and some of the ingredients are you need food, you need shelter, you need health care, you need some education, you need to find the right person in life, You want to have meaningful work. You want the feeling of giving back. The most important ingredient in that cake recipe, the ingredient with the most statistical variability, is where you live.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So if you're unhappy, one of the most powerful things you can do is move to a happier place. And we know there's good research for this too, by the way. When Moldavians who are unhappy in the old Soviet bloc country, they're about a 3 on a scale of 1 to 10. When they move to Denmark, they start reporting about an 8. And a very clever economist by the name of John Halliwell in Canada followed 500,000 immigrants as they move from unhappy places in Africa and Asia to very happy Canada. Canada's number 6 in the world right now. Within 1 year, they start reporting the happiness level of their new adoptive home. Now, their sex stays the same. Their age stays more or less the same. The education level stays about the same. Their sexual orientation stays about the same. Their hormonal inclinations stay about the same. All they do is move. And lo and behold, their happiness goes up. So in the blue zones of happiness, I try to do an anatomy of a happy place. Rather than trying to convince you to change your behavior, positive psychology, meditate or gratitude or positivity or all these other sort of positive psychology tricks, while they may work in the short term, there's absolutely zero evidence they work in the long term. So as soon as you pull the intervention, as soon as you lose focus or lose discipline or lose attention, the benefit of the intervention goes away. But looking at places that are statistically happiest, you can start to see very clearly what are the environmental components that stack the deck in favor of happiness. In other words, how can you shape your ecosystem so that you're more likely to be happy? And there are a few ways, good research. So you start with this assumption that you're going to make long-term changes to your ecosystem. And I break it up into 6 domains. And these domains are all within about a 5-mile life radius of your home. So internally, the only research that shows that you can sort of rewire your brain is when it comes to an intense meditation experience like Vipassana, or really, you know, month-long training, not some app. But learning how to meditate does seem to increase your ability for the long term to stay in the present and appreciate the present. So that meets our criteria. The second domain is your financial life. So you've probably all heard that experiences provide more happiness than things. But it turns out if happiness is your goal, you're much better to spend discretionary income on paying down your mortgage, getting involved in a forced savings plan, or buying insurance than buying a new gadget or new clothes. Because the novelty of a new thing, although it gives you a little burst in quote-unquote happiness for a few months, it wears off in 9 to 14 months. The effect of financial security keeps giving you returns for years or decades or indeed your entire life. There's a few things you can do to your home. Because we know that the happiest people are socially interacting in the world, first of all, you want to pick a neighborhood where there are sidewalks and you're bumping into people who might eventually become your friends. A front porch is better than a back deck for that. Positive emotions count. So an idea from Ed Diener is to create what we call a pride shrine, which is to aggregate the pictures that trigger nice memories, the awards that we've gotten, the pictures of kids, of our vacation spot, and put them on a wall in a place that you walk by a lot during the day, maybe between your bedroom and your bathroom. And it provides a daily little spike in satisfaction. Having a window that looks out on greenery works. Having good light in your home makes an ongoing impact on your positive emotions. Social network is huge, and this is probably where you can make the biggest difference. For every new happy person you bring into your immediate social network, you increase your own chance of happiness by 15%. Loneliness is contagious. Unhappiness is contagious. So if you hang out with people who complain and are negative, you're going to come away from meeting with them feeling negative yourself. So curating this group of five or six friends who like to laugh, who care about you. The criteria is kind of this. You want five friends who, number one, you can have a meaningful conversation with. Number two, you can call them on a bad day and they'll care. And number three, you actually like them. In your work, I pointed out before the importance of doing what you love to do after about $75,000. You know, we need our nut covered, but after you got your nut covered, you're better off and focus on what you're good at. What you like to do. But from 2 million surveys done by Gallup, the biggest determinant of whether or not you like your job is not your boss. It's not your bonus structure. It's whether or not you have a best friend at work. So proactively seeking out somebody. And by the way, we don't live in a culture where you can automatically expect good friends. You got to go out and nurture those responsibilities. Find them and nurture them. So finding that best friend work that makes the three aforementioned characteristics. And then finally, living in the right community, as I pointed out before. And as part of the National Geographic piece, I tried to find the happiest places in America. I worked with Gallup to do an index that looked at 15 ingredients to happiness, including people feel secure. Are they doing new and interesting things every day? And it turns out that the happiest communities in America tend to be walkable and bikeable. Very high correlation between walkability and bikeability and happiness. They have healthy food environments. They have easy access to dentists. And the people take a lot of vacation. So there's where you want to look for in community. So this offers you a different way to think about happiness, not as the focus on me, and try to make myself better, but focus on trying to rebuild my immediate environment to stack the deck in favor of happiness. So I want to come up and talk to Mark here and get your questions, but I want to leave you with one last, let's call it a blessing. So I actually spent 10 years doing this story. And spent some time in northern Mexico, very happy place there, Monterrey, believe it or not. But the soul of northern Mexico is embodied in the character of a guy named Armando Fuentes. They call him El Catón. He's got a lantern jaw, a little guy, writes four columns a day. And I spent a couple days with this guy. He's just so wise and so engaging. And at the very end, I said, "Can you sum up happiness for me?" He said, "Yes, I can." He said, "You want to eat without gluttony, drink without getting drunk, love without jealousy, argue but never go to bed mad, and occasionally, with great discretion, misbehave." Thank you very much.
That's great. Thanks, Dan. I feel happier already, I haven't even done any biking naked, which is great.
So I'm leading a ride after this. For everybody.
I want to remind our radio and podcast audiences that you're listening to Dan Buettner, author of the new book, The Blue Zones of Happiness, Lessons from the World's Happiest People. I'm Mark Zitter. Dan, I'm going to start with a hypothetical question for you. It's a real question, I guess, about a hypothetical situation. And that is, let's assume that President Trump decided he likes this stuff, and he's going to create a new department, a Department of Happiness. And he says, "Dan Buettner is going to be my first U.S. Secretary of Happiness." Okay? What policies would you pursue?
Well, actually, David Cameron's government did just that. And they have this nudge unit, they call it, 50 people. And they've done a few things that actually have worked. For example, they have that point I made about financial security bringing more happiness than consumption. They actually changed the policy for the retirement savings plan in Britain to be opt-out instead of opt-in. So When you got a job, you were automatically enrolled in the savings plan instead of deciding, yeah, maybe I want to do it. And most people are too lazy; they don't do it, or they don't undo it either. But a few things we actually ran a Delphi consensus program along with our writing the book with 18 or so of the top experts. What policies that would bring happiness. First of all, trust is really important, highest correlate. So you want to train policemen. You want to force transparency for our politicians. About 50% of all the unhappiness in a community is driven by people with a mental illness. So I'm going to repeat that. 50% of the unhappiness in a population is people are suffering, most of them from garden variety depression and anxiety. And only about 15% of Americans get treated for that. Every one of those people should be treated in this country. If you have diabetes in this country, almost 100% chance you'd be treated, not with a mental illness. Mental illness, by the way, drives about 50% of the utilization of social services, 50% of the utilization of hospitalization and crime. So you really want to make sure those people get cognitive behavioral therapy, because with just about 12 or 14 sessions, you can resolve about 50% of those. Also, we should have free health care, and not just the platinum take care of problems after they happen, but preventative. I think I mentioned to you in Costa Rica, every man, woman, child has right to a free visit every year from this roving health teams who go into your backyard and look for standing water. They go into your kitchen, look for signs of chronic disease, and they catch a disease before it's a 911 six-figure heart attack or diabetes event. So those are a few ideas.
Great. Okay. We got some questions from the audience, and thank you for your questions, and keep them coming. That had to do with material issues. You know, we work hard in America. We make a fair amount of money compared to the rest of the world. What's the relationship between money and happiness? What's the relationship between home ownership and happiness? And do you think that all the hard work we do here helps create happiness, or detracts from it, or it doesn't make any difference?
My best answer to that question came from the great philosopher Johnny Cash. When asked if money buys happiness, he said, "I don't know if it buys happiness, but it'll buy you a Cadillac so you can drive around and look for happiness." So here's where it's important to know these types of happiness. So when it comes to life satisfaction, that circle, the more money, the happier people say they are in the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. So billionaires are happier than millionaires, who are happier than people who make 100 grand a year. But when it comes to positive affect, daily emotions, happiness kind of tops out about $75,000 a year. So it just depends how you're rebalancing your happiness portfolio. Mm-hmm. If you're a 20-year-old and you don't have your nut covered, you should be maybe working your butt off. But if you're a 40-year-old who's making 100 grand a year, you might ought to be backing off and want to seize the day better than invest in some imagined better life in the future, which half the time never materializes.
And how about the American dream of owning a home? Does that make us happier?
Yes, home ownership is a source of security, and but it's important to be in the right neighborhood. First of all, when it comes to happiness, your realtor will tell you to buy the cheapest home on the block, but a happiness expert will tell you to buy the average home on the block, because you don't want to be surrounded by people with higher status and more money, because that's going to make you unsatisfied with your situation.
Interesting. We have a question from the audience about, is happiness achievable for everyone or even for most people? And I'll combine it with something I read in your book, because I know I'd always heard that people are born with a set point for happiness and it's hard to change that. But it seems like some of the research you cite in your book says that's not true.
Yes. Yeah, so I like, rather than a set point, I think of it as a set range. So about 40% of happiness for a population is dictated by genes. 15 or 20% is by circumstance in life. It's very hard to be happy if you're depressed or if you're chronic pain, or, you know, if you're a Dodgers fan or something. And then 40% or so is really up to you. So there are some people who are dealt a crappy hand, and on a good day, on a scale of 1 to 10, there are 6, and on a bad day, there are 2. And there are people who are dealt a great genetic hand, and on a good day, there are a 10, and on a bad day, there are 6. So what you have control is what you of your life within that range.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the way to think about it.
So I read in your book, you talked about how you convened these 18 experts for this special happiness, Blue Zones of Happiness Consensus Project. And they made recommendations for governments and how to maximize the well-being of their residents. Interesting, they had a whole series of recommendations in order, and the very top one was this: promote volunteering and national service. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so volunteers everywhere are happier than non-volunteers. So that you start there, and then you can only guess why. And I believe we all have 99 problems. We have we might have a shortfall of cash in any given month. A wrinkle might have appeared. Our car's got a dent. Our kid's misbehaving. And we can work really hard to get the top 4 things off those lists, but 4 new things appear. So that list of 99 remains constant. I think when you volunteer and you take the focus off of your own problems and put them on somebody else's problems, especially if those problems are worse, your own 99 problems diminish in your psyche. And that's part of it. I think people who volunteer, they're more likely to get that 6 or 7 hours of social interaction. They're often likely to put their strengths to work when they're not putting it to work mm-hmm. at their jobs. So it's just the best thing you can do if you get fired or laid off, and that's a really big blow for people's happiness, is to volunteer. Mm-hmm. That's the best anecdote for unemployment.
Are there countries around the world where the government does encourage volunteering in that way?
Yeah, there's all kinds of policies that in Denmark and Singapore, they actually start to fund the organizations that seek volunteers. And the agenda is set by leadership. You know, you have like John F. Kennedy, where ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. That impacts the way people think about their lives. So, yes, having a leader who inspires us to volunteer, Peace Corps, et cetera, AmeriCorps, those are all positive things for national happiness.
Well, speaking of national happiness, you quote Ruud Veenhoven? Ruud Veenhoven's work saying that tolerance, and specifically the absence of discrimination, is one of the most important factors associated with life satisfaction within nations. And it seems to be that tolerance is at a bit of a low point here in America currently. So I'm wondering if you think that's affecting our national well-being. And I'll combine that with a question we got from the audience saying, do you think that the election of President Trump has made us less happy?
Well, I don't want to take
without being political, just
yeah,
it's a
right.
factual question.
Well, we'll see how it comes out in the surveys. But yes, you as a rule, you know, everybody, you know, these surveys are going to survey everybody. They're including, you know, immigrants and Muslims and minorities and, you know, people who are under siege for different reasons right now. And they're part of our population. So I can just tell you, first of all, when you do the statistical analysis, tolerance is the way people perceive their lives when it comes to tolerance is very important in the way they perceive their happiness. And Denmark, Singapore, and Costa Rica all excel in tolerance. So we should be focusing on... You know, Thomas Jefferson was actually the first one to point out that the job of a leader is first and foremost to generate happiness. So if our politician's job is to provide the greatest good for us, then they ought to be paying attention to the emerging resource for shaping policy. GDP has been the measure of success or quality of life for 40 years, and GDP is a blunt instrument. And in fact, it's raising GDP for America is not going to bring greater happiness, or at least not incrementally. You're much better off focusing on trust and tolerance and equality, taking care of people with mental illness, and making sure there are preventative health services. Those statistically will bring happiness.
Is there evidence that in America or worldwide where happiness levels are changing, we're getting more happy, less happy? Do we know that?
Well, as a world, well, United States, this is shocking. Despite the fact that our incomes have tripled since World War II, our average happiness is the same. So here we're working our butts off for prosperity, and it's not doing anything for our happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So the world as a whole, I would argue, is getting a little happier. That's because the poorest places are rising up, you know, especially Latin America. Latin America has seen a meteoric rise in quality of life. And if you control for everything else, the Latin Americans are statistically happier with less than anybody else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So they're one of the things that lift the tide that raise all boats.
Speaking of different parts of the world, there was a question here, but you didn't mention much about Africa. Did you look at Africa to see if there were blue zones of happiness there? What do we know about Africa?
So, yes, so GDP is important for poor countries. So there's this native myth, actually, that people take a vacation and go to Africa or Asia, and they see these, you know, poor people who are dancing in the street and they're really hospitable. They're not really happy people. You need food and shelter and health care. You got to have a full belly. People have to be able to have meaningful work, not just, you know, being a goat herder like their father and their great-grandfather, because that's the only thing they can do. So at place, most of Africa, now South Africa is an exception. Egypt is probably a bit of an exception. But most of them don't have enough economic prosperity distributed equally enough to really meet that minimum level of happiness.
So it's the minimum level for both health and wealth that are sort of important.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's the ante.
Yeah.
But in places like Europe and mm-hmm. most of Latin America and the United States, and we ought to be things we could be doing a lot better.
Now, you teased us a bit during your talk when you said you looked at all kinds of places in America to see which ones were the happiest, and you gave some of the criteria that made them happier, but you didn't tell us which was which. And I know that the National Geographic Gallup Special Index of the happiest U.S. cities found the number one happiest city in America to be Boulder, Colorado. By the way, the San Francisco area came in at number 17, which wasn't bad.
No, it's not bad.
And in fact, I think number two was Santa Cruz,
really near here. Spot. Santa Barbara does very well here in California.
Okay, we're pretty competitive around here. So what is it made Boulder number one? Why Boulder?
Well, first of all, medium-sized cities tend to do better because there's less anonymity. But I wrote a bunch about San Luis Obispo, which is also among the top 10. The happiest cities tend to have 50 years or so ago, enlightened leaders that made a very conscious effort to shift away from just developers and economic growth to quality of life policies. So in Boulder, for example, they created a green belt around their city. So one of the great attributes of Boulder is you can live anywhere in town and see the mountains and see the forests. And we know psychologically you're happier if you have exposure to green space. You can leave your office at noon and take a hike for lunch and be back for time for your 1 o'clock meeting. Now that isn't just, if the developers had their way, the mountain view would be wallpapered with houses, big, you know, biggest and nicest houses. But some university professors back in the 60s created what's called a blue line, and there's no development above that. So everybody has this view. The city itself has had the self-discipline to tax to create a green zone, a donut around Boulder so that it doesn't sprawl outward, so the economic vitality turns inward. They passed an ordinance where there are no billboards. Raise your hand if you like billboards. Okay, for the radio audience, there are zero hands up right now. The only people who like billboards are the people who own the billboards and the advertiser. And for the rest of us, most of us don't need to be taunted to buy that thing we don't need or eat that food that's not all that good for us in the first place. And Boulder just said no billboards. San Luis Obispo got rid of drive-thrus and junk food in fast food restaurants. They prioritized, both these places prioritized the bike. One of the most dependably least happy hours of our day is our commute in our car. That comes from Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize. Well, our commute is very much a function at how our cities are planned. And if you just let the sprawl happen, and if you build for cars, induced demand will fill up all your roads. So Boulder and San Luis Obispo and Santa Cruz, these cities that said, well, no, actually, we're going to start building our roads for human beings. So there are trees, and there are wide sidewalks where people can meet, and traffic slows down, and there's not as much noise, and there's not as much pollution. That's a conscious effort by enlightened leaders. That's what makes happy cities.
Mm-hmm. Good question from the audience. It says, I'm 80. I think life is short because there's so much more that I want to do. Can I make it to 100 without eating beans?
No. You got to eat beans. No, I'm just kidding. So let me just say, if you're 80, you have a much better chance. You have a lot better chance than me, for example. So if you've made it to 80 already. The question about long and short and hard and easy, that's just correlative, and it's not necessarily predictive of individuals, predictive of a whole room full of people. So the things that I would say at 80 that are going to most favor your making it to 100 are really nurturing that group of four or five friends who really care about you and who you walk with. I would say switching to a plant-based diet. The reason I promote beans is if you take beans and any grain, you get a high protein meal. A cup of beans and a cup of brown rice has more protein than a hamburger does. And when you get older, you actually need more protein. Your ability to absorb protein diminishes after age 65. So you want high protein foods like beans.
Mm-hmm. What about the effect of retirement age on happiness? And is there sort of an optimal age to retire to maximize your happiness?
I think retirement should be done away with altogether. So the Okinawans, the longest-lived women in the world, they don't even have the word retirement in their vocabulary. There's no, you know, artificial punctuation between your productive life and your older life. Your entire life is imbued with meaning and purpose. I think we have it wrong in this country in thinking that, you know, old people should be warehoused or they're just recipients of care. We undercelebrate the fact, you know, when you use the word wisdom, wisdom has two components. It's knowledge plus experience. So the older people are naturally going to have more wisdom. We should be harnessing that wisdom. And in places where people are living the longest, the word purpose, like ikigai, is not just I'm going to live out my passion. Metabolized in the word is responsibility. So there's a sense that as you get older, you're not just going to be recipient care. You're expected to give back. And there's this mutual celebration of age and a responsibility. So there's a psychosomatic power in sending a message to our 80-year-old friend and people even older that we need you. We expect you to get out of bed in the morning. We expect you to get out of your easy chair. We expect your brain to stay engaged. We expect you to contribute. And as a bonus, people, it seems, live longer and are happier because of it.
Huh. We did talk a bit about the role of marriage and happiness and different elements of that. We had a question that said, I believe you mentioned that men live longest in Sardinia, Italy, and women in Okinawa, Japan. And the question is, what about the reverse genders in those areas?
Yes, yeah, so in most parts of the world, for every one male centenarian, there are five female centenarians. And in Sardinia, Costa Rica and Ikaria, the proportion is 1-1. So where men are living a long time, women live about the same. In other words, the advantage is clearly to the men. In Okinawa, the men don't experience any great longevity there, sort of average longevity. So there's probably 15 female centenarians for every one male centenarian in Okinawa. And there seems to be a high rate of suicide. But it might just be that, you know, women are better at creating a lifelong social network with each other than men are. I don't really know why.
But something different's happening to women in Okinawa than to men that helps them with life expectancy, but not men.
That's right.
Interesting, interesting. Going back to happiness, we've talked about the places in the world where people are most likely to be happy. Are there other individual characteristics, race, gender, something like that, that lead to better happiness? And also, you didn't talk too much about age and happiness, because the different parts, times in our lives, we're more likely to be happy, right?
Right. So happiness is a U-shaped curve. So you tend to be quite happy in your 20s and optimistic. And then it varies from country to country, but usually sometime between age 45 and 55 tend to be the least happy years. And then as long as you keep your health, happiness increases. And actually the happiest cohort are centenarians, healthy centenarians. And it's probably because they've adapted. You know, they adapt to the aches and pains or whatever, the limitations of their dreams, whatever, and they found satisfaction in what they enjoyed. When it comes to gender, this is interesting, especially given, you know, these revelations with Weinstein and so forth, that in places where there is gender equality, the men are happier than the women. And in places where women are not treated fairly, the women are happier than men. So just in self-interest, men ought to be making sure there's gender equality.
That's interesting. You know, you used a metric in your book I hadn't heard of before called happy life years. It was sort of a combination of longevity and happiness. Where did that come from? And do wealthier countries tend to have higher happy life years?
Yes. Ruud Veenhoven, and he's been doing this happiness research forever, and he's very data-driven. He runs the World Database on Happiness. You can go to his website. It's labyrinthine, but he actually tracks these happy life years. And number one in the world is Costa Rica.
Mm-hmm.
And despite the fact that they have their GDP is about one-fifth of what it is in the United States, along with trust and tolerance and GDP, the other big correlate to happiness at the national level is healthy life expectancy. So really the health of a country is very important. So investing in that in the right way is a great investment in happiness.
Now, your book, as well as a lot of other researchers, talk about the importance of socializing and social issues for happiness. And in the book, it says that Americans only socialize an average of 41 minutes a day. But people are happiest on days when they socialize at least 6 hours. Now, most of us work. Some people might have a boss who don't like it when they socialize that much. And to be honest, I might be that boss. So what do people who work for me or other bosses who don't want people socializing all day, what are they to do?
Well, first of all, employers should realize that happy employees are not only more productive, they have fewer sick days. They tend to report a better experience. They're more likely to stay loyal to you. So maybe giving them more time to socialize is actually a good investment for you. But having lunch with a friend rather than eating alone at your desk, in that hour a day you should be getting some physical activity, walking with a friend, having dinner with somebody. Your family counts, by the way, on this. Mm-hmm. Instead of watching 4.4 hours of TV, which the average American does, using that TV time to belong to a club or volunteer or just go out with friends or do happy hour. We evolved as social creatures. The reason we're successful as a species is because we figured out how to socialize, and you know, evolution tends to make us feel good about the things that favor our survival. So yielding to that natural urge to socialize is not only good for our happiness, but it's also good for our health.
Great. Well, you've given us, I promised people, some take-home advice for happiness, and you've given us a tremendous amount, maybe to make it easier for people. If you could pick one recommendation, a practical recommendation that individuals here could use to be happier, what would that be?
Let me give you four, just four quick
ones. Wow.
You want something to do, someone to love, something to look forward to, and something to give back. That's it right there.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
What do you mean pretty good?
That's pretty good. Or, I mean, got to remember all those. But
thank
yeah, we
you
could
guys.
Probably,
see, these
probably
guys love
that.
Me.
Well, unfortunately, we've come to the point in the program where there's time for just one last question, and I'm going to use moderator privilege and ask that for you, Dan. So I'm interested in how you've put your life towards this work for over a decade. Of all this work and all the time you spent, how has doing this work changed you. And I'm especially interested in if it's made you happier.
Well, my purpose, I mean, this is what I love to do. So you could argue that I never stop working, or you could argue that I never stop playing. So this is, you know, if I had to sum up my life purpose, what I'm good at is going to parts of the world, interacting with traditional people and distilling their wisdom. That is my personal mission statement. I get to do that all the time with the greatest organization in the world, National Geographic, on expense account. But the big things I learned, so I've become mostly vegan over the course of studying longevity and happiness. I'm a big believer in that. I'm very clear-eyed about the sort of futility of trying to get too much money. It's a Sisyphean pursuit. So I like to socialize, so I spend a lot of time socializing. I don't skimp on sleep. It's very hard to get me to do something early in the morning, so I sleep that 7.5 hours. And I think following those things, and then having that, I have triaged a lot of people from my life who aren't really true friends, and focused really on that group of 4 or 5 friends, and they know who they are, and it makes a huge difference, I think. So that would be it.
Great. We're going to leave it at that. I want to thank Dan Buettner, the author of The Blue Zones of Happiness, Lessons from the World's Happiest People. I want to thank everyone here in San Francisco, as well as our audience on the radio, television, and the internet. A reminder to the San Francisco audience that immediately following this session, Dan's book is for sale, and he will sign copies outside of this room. I'm Mark Zitter of the Zedema Project, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know and usually quite happy, is adjourned.